All right. Hi, everyone. My name is Sean Lazar. I think everybody here, well, I don't know. There's a couple new faces, but mostly everyone knows me, I think. I work for GES. And I was going to talk on one topic, but I decided last night, honestly, at 11 o'clock at night, I was like, no, I want to do something different. Seriously. That's why I'm drinking Red Bull right now. They once did a blood test and they found traces of blood in my Red Bull, you know, because I drink a lot of it. So I wrote this journal article on a theology of eating, breaking bread, a theology of eating. It should come out in a couple months, but I just wanted to, I don't know, I was so excited about this topic, I thought that it'd be something that would really resonate with the people here. And I'm so excited because who is in Dr. Craig Glickman's talk just earlier? Pretty much everyone. And there he said that church should really be like a what? Like a Thanksgiving meal. And I was like, yes! And I talked to him a little bit about that afterwards. And then at lunch today, I was pronouncing your name wrong, Joy. Buffet. I apologize. Buffet. The Buffets and the Davises. And we were talking about their breakfast church that you guys went to for 10 years, which is only a theoretical idea for me, but it was practice for you guys for like 10 years or so. And then Catherine just gave a talk on feasts and the importance of feasts, right, in the Bible. And she was talking about how a lot of the commentators just note, like, wow, they really talk about eating a lot, and then that's it. They just drop the ball. They don't kind of revisit it. Why is this important? And so I wrote this article about eating, and it just opened up so much of the Bible for me. So before we start, let's just say a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, we are hungry for your word, and I pray that you feed us through your word in this session and through this whole conference. And I pray that as we leave this conference, you'll give us a lot of food for thought. And I pray that it won't just stay thought, that it'll actually become action in our lives. I ask this in the name of Jesus. Amen. Is this clear, by the way? Is this all right? I found Dr. Glickman's talk to be so low, I was just straining to hear what he was saying. So, what does Jesus want you to be doing? I've been a Christian since I was 17. I became a Christian in 1995, and so you do the math. And Christianity still seems so new to me. I feel like it's just so fresh, it's so new. And I'm always asking myself or asking the Lord, I mean, what do you want me to be doing? Do you guys ever ask that question? What do you want me to be doing? What can I be focusing on? What kinds of spiritual activities do people actually emphasize? Do you know what kind of church this is by any chance? It's an Orthodox church. Very good. And this wall is called an iconostasis. It's an icon screen, and it separates the people from the priests on the inside who are saying the prayers over the bread and the wine, and so that it becomes the real presence of the body and blood of Christ in their belief. And I spent some time in the Orthodox Church, and they're usually decorated quite beautifully from an aesthetic point of view, but there's just icons everywhere. And you walk into an Orthodox church, and usually there's an icon of Mary, the Mother of God, right at the beginning, and then there's usually an icon of the patron saint of the church. And you go to the icon, and you do a double bow, and then you kiss the icon, and you do another cross yourself, and you bow. And you walk in, and you usually do like a little procession around the church, kissing, bowing, and venerating all the icons of the church. The question is, where is the New Testament verse or chapter that describes how to make icons and how to venerate and how to bow down to them? Is there such a chapter? There is not. I have taken courses on how to paint icons in the apostolic way. There's all these traditions about how to make icons. All this energy that is spent building, making, printing, selling, venerating, kissing, all that stuff. There's a lot of hours spent on icons. Has God ever asked anyone to do that to an icon? No. Does God emphasize those things? If not, why? Well, what are some other examples that people kind of spend a lot of time on, a lot of energy on. One of the things that came to mind, I first asked myself this question, like really, really personally, when I was kind of like eyeballs deep into a study of revivals. I love reading about revivals, revivals in Scotland, in Kentucky, in Toronto, in Florida, Wesley's revivals, Charles Finney's revivals, how to do revivals, how to conduct revivals, how to promote them, how to conduct them, how to sustain them, all these kind of, all this information about how to do revivals. Where is the chapter in the New Testament that says we should spend any time trying to conduct revivals? There really isn't. Somehow it's become part of our evangelical culture, but it's not like God said, by the way, I love these things called revivals, and I really want you to be like a revivalist, and here's how you go around promoting revival. It's a part of our tradition just as much as the iconostasis has become part of the Orthodox tradition. As evangelicals, we have our own kind of traditions that we kind of focus on and we think are really important that God has said absolutely nothing about. So I can't pick on the Orthodox. It's kind of easy to pick on the Orthodox or the Catholics. This is a picture of a Mormon temple. Temples are really important to Mormons. They're building them all over the place. Did the apostles ever build a single temple? Not at all. They couldn't care less about temples. But the Mormons spend millions of dollars on them. God never asked us to build temples. So it's easy to pick on the Mormons. It's easy to pick on the Orthodox. But what about evangelicals? What are some of the things that we really emphasize? One thing that Bob and I, we're always emphasizing among ourselves is going to seminary. How much time and energy we've thought about seminary, going to seminary, spending in seminary, getting these higher degrees. Did Jesus or the apostles ever say, don't start preaching until you get this MA or MDiv degree from seminary? It's totally made up. It's something that evangelicals have made up. Now, there is Christian liberty to do things. There is Christian liberty to do things. But I started to ask myself the question, I have liberty to do this, but what actually has God emphasized that we do? Other spiritual activities. What other? Do you guys have anything come to mind? How about church architecture? Anyone love church architecture? I love architecture. I wanted to be an architect. I love Abby. We might be able to go on a vacation without the kids for the first time in like 15 years or so. No, we've only had kids for about 8 years, so the first time in 8 years. But we're kind of at a standstill because she wants an all-inclusive beach vacation, and I just want to walk around an old city and look at museums. So it's kind of like, where do we find the place where you can do both? I don't know. But I love architecture. I love looking at the buildings, visiting the buildings. It's like the churches in Europe are full, but they're full of tourists. There aren't anyone who's actually worshiping there, but they're all looking at the buildings. But where? I've read books about the theology of architecture and how important it is and how it helps you transcend the earth and get into communion with God. But where in the Bible does it talk about building the cathedrals and stuff? Did Jesus ever emphasize that? Not really. And yet we consider a modern-day pastor to be successful if he's run a good building program, multi-million-dollar building program. So if God doesn't emphasize those kinds of things, what does he emphasize? That was kind of my question. And I came on this theme of eating in the Bible. And I just want to show you that God doesn't say anything about going to seminary, anything about conducting revivals, anything about icons, anything about all these things that we consider very important. But he does say a lot about eating. And I just want to focus, hey, maybe this is something that we should pay more attention to. So for example, eating was really important for fellowship in the New Testament. William Barclay, who I wouldn't recommend everything by him, he's be careful when you read him. But this book, The Lord's Supper, is really good. And he says, to share a common meal, especially if the act of sharing the meal also involves the sharing of a common memory, is one of the basic expressions of human fellowship. Who here has been eating together with people at the conference? Right, I just kind of ate out with you guys, and I ate out with you guys. And isn't that one of the best parts of the conference? Because what's happening when you're eating with people? Now, I want to be interactive, so you tell me, what is happening when you're sitting down and you're eating with people? You're talking together. What's that? Your mouth is full of food. Yes, that's true. Yes.
You're eating.
You're eating. I'm wary now of asking you guys to getting answers from you guys. But
you're sharing life.
What does it say about, what are you saying to the person who is sitting down and eating a meal with you? What are you telling that person?
You enjoy them.
You value them. A lonely person, what does a lonely person really need to know?
That they're valued.
That someone is thinking about them, someone cares about them. I'm going to have an example of how that was a huge, something that happened to my wife that really just, really saved her. But I'm going to save that till the end. Now, do we see that truth expressed in the New Testament? Who is in Catherine's talk, right? A bunch of you. And what did Catherine emphasize? Did Jesus eat out with people a lot? A lot, all the time. Religious leaders actually faulted Jesus for eating with tax collectors and sinners, and they spread the rumor that he was too gluttonous to be a genuine prophet. So Jesus was eating out so often with people, he was actually being criticized for it. So if it was important to Jesus to eat out, do you think it might be important for us to eat with people? Eat out with people? Maybe. But let's try to understand the reason why it might be important for Jesus to do that. The first Christians, what did they do on a daily basis? They organized and they held revival meetings. Is that what they did? They had a little singing or something. No, they didn't do that either. What did they do? And they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine. They started a seminary. Is that what they did? They're like, let's get a seminary and start issuing master's degrees. In the breaking of bread and in prayers. So they continued how often? Daily, with one accord in the temple. And what did they do? And say breaking bread loud. Breaking bread. From house to house, they ate their food with gladness and simplicity of heart. They met together, and what did they do together? They ate. How often did they do it? Once a month? Once a quarter? Like a good Baptist? Daily. They ate together daily. Why would they eat together daily? Or were they just being social? Were they just extra friendly? Do they just like having the company? What does the New Testament say about eating and the meeting of the church? Listen to this. Or read this. Okay, so when you think of church, what do you think of? As an evangelical, you're picturing it in your mind, and what do you see? What do you see? You see red carpet, pews. Okay, you're sitting in a pew, and you're looking up front, and what's happening? There's music, and there's preaching. Who gives this? What kind of preaching is it? Same man every Sunday. He gives what is called the sermon, and would it be fair to say it's a monologue? It's a monologue sermon, is that right? And so you're sitting in front, you're sitting in your pew, and wait, you walk in and you have about 10 minutes to say, like, hey, how's it going, right? And then you have to sit and you're just like, sit face front. You can't really talk to the people in back of you. Maybe you can talk to the people, but most of you are just passive, sitting in the front, listening to someone deliver a monologue sermon. Is that fair to say? Doesn't matter where you go in the world, that's kind of what an evangelical church looks like. What did the early Christians do? Well, we just kind of read about it a little bit, right? They met together daily to eat. But now watch this. For first of all, when you come together as a church, not every time Christians come together is it a meeting of the church. That has to be kind of a deliberate thing. Just because you're having coffee with your buddy or whatever, that's not suddenly a church meeting. There's something intentional about meeting as a church. And by the way, Bob Bryant has a talk about this from last year, which I highly recommend, that I'm drawing on a little bit here, but basically we have the same conclusions. So when you come together as a church, so there's a specific church meeting that Paul is talking about, I hear that there are divisions among you, and Paul hates divisions. When you come together in one place, it's not to eat the Lord's Supper. They thought they were eating the Lord's Supper, but Paul's going to critique them. For in eating, each one takes his own supper ahead of others, and one is hungry, and another is drunk. What? Don't you have houses to eat and drink in? Or do you despise the church of God and shame those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I praise you in this? I do not praise you. What's interesting about this section is what Gerd Thiessen points out. He says, and actually, I won't get there yet. I'll go. What's interesting is, are they just having like a little bit of cracker and a little bit of grape juice? How do we know they're not? Because some people are getting drunk, and some people are going hungry, which presumes what? What should be normal? They should be able to have enough to fill them up. And so Paul is faulting them for eating the Lord's Supper in the wrong way, so that it's not even really, in his opinion, a Lord's Supper anymore. This is from Bob Ryan, and I mentioned it down here. When Paul describes the Lord's Supper, look at the color-coded stuff here and ask yourself, how many elements are there? In a typical evangelical church, how many elements are there in the Lord's Supper? You have two things, right? What are they? Bread and the juice, or bread and the wine, if you're in a liberal or a Plymouth Brethren church. For I received from the Lord that which I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the same night in which he was betrayed, took bread, so that's bread, bread is there, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, take, eat, this is my body, which is broken for you, do this in remembrance of me. In the same manner, he also took the, you got the cup, but when did he take it?
After supper.
How many elements are there? There's three elements. You got the bread, you got the supper, then you have the cup. Do we have any more kind of information? Now, would that make sense? Would the fact that they're eating a supper make sense of this? Some people going hungry when they shouldn't be, and some people getting drunk when they shouldn't be? There's a real meal that's happening, right? I love what this little quote from Gerd Thiessen, and I'll put this on our website, these PowerPoints if you want them. But the article is coming out in a couple months, and I'll put that out there too. The formula presumes that there's a meal between the word over the bread and that spoken over the cup. Bread, supper, cup. And Wayne Meeks, the basic act of the Lord's Supper is the eating of a common meal at which it is possible that one goes hungry and another is drunk. Now, I know you guys have celebrated the Lord's Supper this way, but how many people here have celebrated the Lord's Supper with a full meal before? Okay, more people than would be normal for evangelicals. But we're not really a normal group, are we? Oh, there you go. There you go. That's where I celebrated that too. The word for supper, some people are like, yeah, but the bread, the little piece of bread, that's the supper. No, it isn't. And we know it's definitely not that, because the word Paul uses for supper is the most common word for this evening meal that they have. And again, this is from Barclay. The word is dapnon. It may be that to Western ideas, the word supper is misleading. From the West, supper is a light meal. But in Greece and in Palestine, the dapnon was the evening meal, and it was the only main meal of the day. Basically, they'd have just a little bit of food in the morning, a little bit of food at night, and the dapnon, the supper, was the main nourishment of the day, especially for poor people. This is going to be very important as we kind of go over the evidence here. When I was doing kind of background reading about how did Jewish people and Greek people eat their evening family meals at that time, and here's what I found out. This is a typical family meal. The commencement of the meal was marked by the head of the household taking a piece of bread in his hands and saying a prayer of thanks over it. The bread was then broken into pieces shared among those present. Similarly, at the end of the meal, the host took a cup of wine known as the cup of blessing and gave thanks to God for it, after which all present drank. So it started with bread, you had the meal, and it ended with the cup. Does that sound like how Paul describes the Lord's Supper? Yes. They are having a family meal together. Because why? What have they become now that they've believed in Jesus? They've become family. The church is not a social club where you anonymously more or less come in the morning, say hi to people, and then leave and never see them ever again. They're really a family. Eating and the location of the meeting. Okay, so they ate regularly. The early Christians ate together every day. They ate to celebrate this Lord's Supper, and this Lord's Supper wasn't a token ritualized meal. It was a full meal, and a full family meal was usually eaten where? At home, right? Where the supper was prepared. So where did the early Christians meet? They met in big elaborate temples that they built, right? They met in giant cathedrals that they raised up to the glory of God. That's what they did. Or big conference centers or something. That's where they met, right? Not at all. The early Christians met in homes. The churches of Asia greet you. Aquila and Priscilla greet you heartily in the Lord with the church that is in there. Greet the brethren who are in Laodicea and Nymphis and the church that is in his. I have a long list of the verses that say the church Christians met in houses, and you can see that in the New Testament. But why would it make sense that they would meet in their house? Because what are they meeting to do? They're meeting to eat the meal that they would prepare normally in the evening. They're eating their family supper. So of course they're meeting in houses. They're not even meeting in synagogues because they're not necessarily eating in synagogues. They're eating a meal together, so they meet in their homes. Now the rich people met in homes. These are probably the rich people. Most ancients lived in these basically 4 or 5 story apartments called, Robert Jewett calls them tenement houses, and I'll just leave it a tenement buildings. I'll just leave it at that. So the early Christians were powerfully uninterested in raising buildings. The oldest church we know of is the Dura Europus Church, and it's from the 3rd century, and it was a house. You don't find churches until like what we think of as separate church buildings specifically built for, you know, religious activity until Constantine, basically. And there's this great quote from Eusebius where he says, after Constantine legalized Christianity, it became clear that he favored Christianity. A lot of people, and Eusebius is describing it as if this is a good thing. All these people came into the church and they became Christians, and they wanted to raise up buildings to the glory of God. So there's all these brand new believers thinking, man, these Christians meeting in these dirty little homes, that's not good enough. We need to build these temples just like we used to pay for these pagan temples. Well, now we're going to build these temples to this new God that the emperor favors. That's really where church architecture comes from. It's kind of interesting. But for about 200 years, 250 years, Christians just met in homes. Now, think of the mindset that requires. Imagine that the founding fathers of this country never even thought to build the White House or the Capitol building until the 1990s, 200 plus years after the founding of this country. Imagine if they were so uninterested in buildings, they're like, we're not even going to make provisions for this until a couple centuries later. That's what the church was like. They didn't even think of building buildings. That came much, much later. So where did they meet? They met in homes. A typical Roman house had 2 areas. It had a triclinium, which was kind of like the dining room for the family, and it can hold up to 9 people. Then they had an atrium, which was kind of usually open to the sky. It was kind of like a garden area, and it can hold maybe, they think maybe 20 people comfortably, but if you stuff them in, about 40. So they think a typical house church in Paul's time, in these Roman houses, if you're one of the wealthy, could fit about 50 people. But most Christians probably met in these apartments. Does anyone remember the story of Eutyches? What happened to Eutyches? Paul was talking and talking and talking, and Eutyches was sitting at the window, and he fell from the 3rd story, and he died. But then Paul raised him from the dead. But that tells you people were meeting in these tenement apartments. They were meeting in apartments, right? Because he was 3 stories up. And we also think they met in shops located. These shops were located at the front part of a house that was on the main street, or the shops, it was a way for the owners to make money, or the shops were like located at the bottom of these apartment buildings. But anyways, the point is they would meet where they'd usually prepare and eat the evening supper. Eating and doing ministry. Okay, so why are the Christians like meeting together? We've explored some of the reasons why. You know, they're fellowshipping together. It's a way of showing that they love each other, that they're a family. It's also a way of doing ministry, because what did Jesus do when he was going around eating at people's homes? Did Jesus just kind of stop? You know, did he just clam up or just start talking politics? What did he start doing when he was eating with people? He's teaching. He's dialoguing. Catherine was just kind of going over all of that. Alexander, I don't know how to pronounce the last name. Strauch. So Alexander Strauch says Jesus is the prime example of someone who reached people through the door of hospitality. This book, Hospitality, 5 stars, highly recommend it. Get it. It's just a booklet, so it's easier to read. Great book. He's the prime example of someone who reached people through the door of hospitality. I'm doing a doctorate in preaching. I love preaching. And then one day I came across this article by this Anabaptist named Stuart Murray. And Stuart Murray said, it's just a short blog, you can find it online on interactive preaching. He said there really isn't anything like an evangelical sermon in the New Testament. Instead, in the New Testament, you have dialogue and highly interactive preaching in social situations. And so basically Jesus sits and he's doing his teaching at a meal, and it's in answer to questions and it provokes questions and it kind of goes along with this interaction with the people that he's eating with. So New Testament teaching and preaching isn't like what I'm doing right now. It's more like what we were doing at lunchtime, just talking together about the things of God. When Jesus sent out the 70, so how did early Christians support ministers? How is eating connected to ministry? Well, when Jesus sent out the 70, he told them not to bring their own provisions, but to stay at the first house that welcomed them. In other words, mission depended on hospitality. You had these traveling preachers, and the only way they can do ministry was if they were going to be supported and fed, right? By people who supported them and sent them along on the mission. 3 John is an example of him praising. Who is he praising? Who is it? Gaius, right? It's Gaius, I think. Beloved, you're acting faithfully in whatever you accomplish for the brothers and sisters. It's like whatever you accomplish is like taking care of these traveling teachers, and especially when they're strangers who have borne witness of your love before the church. If you send them forward on your journey, before you wanted to send your guest with a bag full of food and maybe some money to keep on so they can make it to the next town, right? So hospitality, feeding Christian ministers helps promote Christian ministry. Eating was probably part of Paul's church planting strategy. His strategy seems to have been, he'd go to the synagogue, he'd usually get a poor welcome there, but if he ever made a contact, you often find these household conversions in the New Testament. And those household conversions, we think, became the nucleus of a house church, which then became kind of the focal point of Paul's ministry in that city. If he found someone who was going to show him hospitality, where he was meeting became the focal point of his ministry to that whole city. This is an amazing book. Vincent Brannick, House Church in the Writings of Paul. It's amazing. I love it. Great book. You need to get it. It's by a Roman Catholic dude, and he sees that the New Testament has nothing to do with the Roman Catholic style of church structure or worship, but he's just honest with the text, and he's saying this is what they did. And there must have been a development over the centuries to get where we are now, but this is what it was like, and it kind of looks different from what we do. Eating and evangelism. Eating provided an opportunity to invite people to hear Jesus. Think about if Jesus comes to your house, what are you going to do? Is it just going to be you and Jesus? What are you going to do? You're going to invite your friends to come hear him, right? Remember when Jesus calls Matthew? Matthew calls all his tax collector friends to this feast because he wants his friends to hear Jesus. It's really easy. It can be awkward to invite a friend, an unbeliever, to sit in a pew on Sunday morning to listen to a lecture for an hour. But is it awkward to invite your friend over to your house for a meal? No, that's easy. We all do that all the time. So eating might be more helpful to evangelism. And we have examples of that in 1 Corinthians where They're meeting together to eat. And Paul assumes that there's going to be outsiders and unbelievers who are there. That's how people become Christians. You invite them to this love feast or this Lord's Supper, this meal together, and they're in the place of the outsider, so they don't have exactly the same position as everyone else, but they're there and they're seeing the fellowship and they're hearing the teaching, and maybe they're even asking questions. I don't have a whole lot of time left, so I will just kind of skip to the end. For the early Christians, the home was the most natural setting for proclaiming Christ to their families, neighbors, and friends. And unless we open the doors of our homes to one another, the reality of the local church as a close-knit family of loving brothers and sisters is only a theory. Eating in charity. Catherine kind of went over this a little bit. I'll just touch on it. We're commanded to feed the poor. When your church service has nothing to do with eating, when you're just sitting, listening to a sermon, it's really hard to make that connection. Okay, how can we help the poor out? But when your church service consists of feeding people, feeding hungry people, is it easy to feed the poor? Is it easy to minister to the poor in that scenario? It's more natural. It's more organic. That's what you're doing. You want to feed hungry people. But I'll just skip. And the early Christians, of course, they immediately started doing that for the widows, right? You know, they were feeding the widows every day because they were meeting to eat every day. Eating in church discipline. If you're not eating together, you really can't obey these commands. Don't even eat with such a person, someone who's a Christian who's sexually immoral. There's a lot of church discipline for behavior, but I don't find a whole lot of verses that call for church discipline based on, you know, theological differences. But if you're not eating together, you can't obey these. There's a bunch of commands about don't eat with such a person as a form of discipline. Remove the spots. I'll skip that. No work, don't eat. If someone doesn't work, they shouldn't eat. That's not just... Anyways, I'll skip that. Eating and eschatology. Does eating have anything to do with the return of Jesus? There's so much evidence. We're proclaiming his death. The future is kind of is portrayed as the wedding supper of the Lamb. There's all kinds of interesting connections there. But I will skip all that stuff. In application... Let me just give you this one story. I have 2 minutes. I have 2 minutes and 40 seconds here. Let me just give you this application. You guys know my story. A lot of you know my story about how my wife and I got married. We met online, and we were talking on the phone a lot, but we only actually met in person twice before we got engaged. And we got married after... Probably we spent a total of about 3 weeks together in person. And we got married on a Sunday, and then we moved on a Saturday, and we moved to Amsterdam in Europe on the Sunday. And there was like a flight delay, but anyways, on Monday morning, we woke up, and we both thought, what did we just do? Who is this person? This is a voice on the telephone. Who is this person? And it was quite a shock to us. We thought we talking on the phone is not the same thing as being obviously next to a person. So I was at school there, and Abby stayed at home. And I had taken her from West Texas, away from all of her friends, away from her church, away from her family, and she was now with this basically a stranger in a foreign country with nothing to do. I had school, and what she had nothing to do but cry, and she cried a lot. Those first like 6, 7, 8 months or so. And the more she cried, the more I was like, what is this woman creature doing crying? So I buried myself in schoolwork. I was like, oh, I need to go to the library, see ya. And she'd just be at home crying, and I'd go to the library, and I did all the classwork for a theology degree and all the classwork for a philosophy degree, I say it's just for kicks, but I know now is because I was trying to avoid the crying of the woman. We were living in this student apartment, and one of my classmates was this woman from South Africa named Anne-Lene Talliard. She's about 10 years older than us, and she saw that Abby was in pain. And she just lived down the hall from us in the student apartment. She saw Abby was in pain, so what she did was she went out of her way to ask Abby to have rooibos, South African rooibos tea with her every day. She invited Abby to have this tea with her. And when Abby turned It was her birthday in October. She took Abby out for her first alcoholic beverage. Abby had never had an alcoholic beverage before. She found it was very tasty. It was a gin and tonic. But my point is, Anne Lene, with two cups, some hot water, and two tea bags, saved Abby. She saved, I don't want to say she saved our marriage, but from my perspective, I don't, because only God knows, but she saved our marriage. She talked Abby off of that ledge with just a cup of tea. What do you call that? Do you call that, is that ministry? That is ministry. Now, who here has a teacup or a coffee cup? Who here has a table? Who here knows somebody who is lonely, who's hurt, who is in trouble, that you can invite over for a cup of tea? Not everybody here is going to be doing what I'm doing, but everybody here can invite someone over for a meal. Is that right? And guess what? I don't know how much impact this will have, but whatever you do, that meal, that coffee cup, that tea with that person, will probably have a huge impact on the person that you're doing that for. And so my point is, Free Grace people, we have the salvation message down. I think we have a lot of work to do on the discipleship aspect. And what I see in New Testament discipleship is that it's not just about us preaching the word. Everybody has a hugely important role to do. And it doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter how young you are. I'll give you one last example. My daughter Daphne is 8 years old, and there's a girl in her class who does not talk to anybody. She doesn't talk. She whispers to the teacher. She has to go up and just whisper something to the teacher. And Daphne is extremely quiet. She's kind of introverted. When I asked her what she wanted to do for her birthday, she said she wanted a by myself birthday. She said she wanted to wake up in her room alone with the presents already there and the cake already there, and she wanted to be left alone with Kitty all day long. By myself birthday. Well, Daphne became friends with this girl, and she went over to this girl's birthday party. And I was like, did you talk? And she said, well, she doesn't really talk. But by the end of the school year, this girl's now talking. Not like I'm talking, but like talking to more than just the teacher in whispers at the end of class. Because just being there with a person is ministry. Just eating with someone is ministry. And it's incredibly healing. And so that's what I want to see all of us do. Thank you very much. I don't know how much time we have left for questions, but any questions? What are you thinking?
1 minute.
1 minute.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Do you think as the persecution, I know we're not under persecution per se, but as it ramps up possibly, don't you think we'll go back to the smaller home churches possibly?
I think so. I think there's tons of churches out there which they would save themselves a lot of trouble if they became house churches. They'd save themselves the rent and the upkeep of a building, and they'd gain all the intimacy of meeting with people in a home around a meal. And I think it'd be way more impactful. I go to church, but we meet with about 5 other families about once a month, and with a few others a little more often than that. And it has been so amazing, so healing to make these friends for the first time. Abby and I we've moved a lot. We haven't had a whole lot of friends over the years. Well, this is the first time just eating together, talking with people around a dinner table that we've really found healing for ourselves and encouragement. You know, when we're down, someone's going to encourage us. When they're down, we can encourage them because we're actually in our lives. The girls, the wives are really good friends, and they say they do life together. And so I almost always have some strange kid at my house because they're all babysitting for each other. So I never know who's going to be there. But incredibly healing. And it's ministry. It's not just being a good person. You're really living the life of Christ together as a community. But you need to get together as a community to do that, I think.
Okay, so do you think the best model for this is like lots of smaller churches instead of like a big church, so that like people can like meet in homes, there's just lots of them all over?
I think what's important is that you be connected to a group, and I can't be connected to 300 people. It's impossible. But I can be connected to like 12 people, you know? So long as you have that circle of connection, I think that's what's important. Yeah.
Joy Lynn. Bring up the psychological aspect that God created us. Like, we go back to Tom Lost Dogs. If you're eating something good and you're with people, you just like them more.
Yeah, yeah, yes. Yeah.
The relationship's
going to
be richer.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Because, I mean, just, I mean, what's your name, sir? Yeah.
Blake.
Now, have you met Chuck, who's sitting behind you? You guys are like 1 foot apart or 2 feet apart, and you're basically strangers. And you'll probably, you know, if this was the meeting week after week, you'd probably never really connect. But if you ask Chuck to pass the bread, and he's sitting right here, you might actually talk to him and get to know him. Does that make sense? So it's a totally different way of just facing each other makes a huge difference. Anyways, yeah. Well, you guys are dismissed. Thank you very much for attending.